That's saxophonist Branford Marcellus and his quartet with an Andrew Hill composition, Snake Hip Waltz. It's from the group's latest album, The Secret Between the Shadow and the Soul. This is Jazz Nightly on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. Branford Marcellus first made his name in jazz in the early 1980s as a member of Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers, along with younger brother Wynton. He next spent a few years in Wynton's band before leaving to join Sting's pop rock group in 1985. He was the band leader for 2 years on The Tonight Show when Jay Leno took over as host in 1992. Marcellus also mixed hip-hop rhythms with jazz in his group Buckshot LaFunk and is a frequent soloist with classical music ensembles. Branford Marcellus formed his first quartet in 1986, and this group remains his primary means of musical expression. His current quartet features pianist Joey Calderazzo, bassist Eric Rivas, and drummer Justin Faulkner. Calderazzo and Rivas have been in the quartet for some 20 years, and Faulkner joined in 2009 when he was still in his teens. He replaced drummer Jeff Tane Watts. Marcellus brings his quartet to Sioux Falls on Wednesday for an evening performance at the Washington Pavilion. Tickets are available at the Washington Pavilion box office. I spoke to Marcellus earlier this week, and he said the longevity of his quartet's lineup creates a freedom of adventure because they can play things they couldn't outside of a regular, consistent working group.
One of the criticisms about jazz in general to a lot of people is they say, well, when I'm listening to it, it all sounds the same. And they're not incorrect, because if you don't play with regular working people, then you're stuck with the standard repertoire that jazz musicians tend to play all around the world. And even when they are familiar with it, with one another, they're not listening to each other when they play, because when you're playing the system, the most important thing is that you start and stop at the same time. It's very possible to be in groups that start and stop at the same time and don't really pay attention to one another, don't listen. When you start working with the same people, there's a familiarity that you get that is actually quite instructive. So then you start saying things as, why do you play this every time we get to this spot? And then they'll say, no, I don't. Say, yes, you do. And then the next day they play, they say, oh, my God, I do. Like, you don't have those conversations with strangers. And then you start to develop a dialogue, and then suddenly we can play rubato songs and ballads, and we don't have to play the same types of songs that are generally played in jazz groups. So I think it's really important.
Well, it sounds to me like you have the freedom then to just branch out as far as you want, the four of you just working together, that there's no necessarily any limitations. It's just, I guess the only limitations would be your own imaginations.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's some, but mostly you're right. Yeah, there's not really a lot of limitations. That's why the records can be as varied as they are. I think the strength of the group is not trying to play to each individual's strengths. We develop a group character, and I'm really good about picking songs that challenge us as a group and force us to play outside of our comfort zone.
Now, though this is your quartet, you're the leader of the band, this group strikes me as being very much collaborative, four equal voices. Is that your preferred way of working?
Well, it's not really four equal voices. It's just one voice. You know, you really can't. I mean, that's the problem with the other groups. I guess one great story is I was playing with when I was 14 years old, I was playing with an R&B singer. And I was playing my stuff, you know, working on my stuff, listening to myself, patting myself on the back. And she turns around and she rips me on the stage, basically saying, don't play that crap behind me when I'm singing. And I came home and told my dad, and my dad laughed, which didn't really help the situation. And he said, hey, you know, when you play with a singer, your job is to support the singer, because the singer's the star of the show. And if you don't like that, then don't play with singers. And that was a super informative moment. So if you've ever been to a jam session and you watch guys lining up to play, and as one guy is playing, there's a guy behind him who's playing into the wall, working out the stuff that he's about to play. That is not a very spontaneous approach. It's more about the particular individual playing things that brings the best possible light to them as individuals. So when I'm playing with a group, it's not four equal individuals. It's a cohesive unit. It's a cohesive unit. And if one person is on the stage thinking about their solo or something they're playing and staring down at the piano, for instance, and smiling at his fingers while I'm playing, that is not a person that I'm going to be very thrilled about working with in the future.
So four musicians creating one voice, is that a better way to put it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's just one voice. And the voice constantly shifts depending on the song.
I mentioned that this group that you're currently working with has been together mostly for two decades, with the change Justin Faulkner.
Well, it's actually 10 years.
10 years with Justin Faulkner.
Because whenever a new person joins, then the group starts over.
So what did Justin Faulkner, how did he, when he came in on the drums, how did the group change?
If you listen to the records, it's really apparent that Jeff Tane Watts isn't there anymore. And Justin had to go and figure out a way to incorporate the things that he knew and the things that he did with us. But there were also a significant number of things he did not know how to do. So we had to give him the time to develop a jazz vocabulary, for lack of a better way of putting it. He had a really good drum vocabulary, but not a great jazz vocabulary. There were too many things he didn't know how to do. He didn't know how to play in the style of the 20s or the 30s. He didn't know how to play avant-garde music. He didn't know how to do any of that. So he already had, because he played in church since he was little, he had the beat. He had the jazz beat. But then the jazz vocabulary, despite, I think in modern times, when you say jazz vocabulary, most music students think harmony. But jazz is its own style and its own sound and has its own vocabulary. So we had to give him enough time, about 2 years really, to start to develop enough of a jazz vocabulary to start to develop himself within the context of the group. And one interesting thing is that there's 7 years between quartet recordings. And he sounds totally different now than he did 7 years ago.
Did his youth have much of an impact? Because the other guys
no.
in the band...
Well, his youth did have an impact because we have a reputation of playing with a lot of intensity, and we thought we were. But, you know, it's like anything. You know, you get old. And you're playing together, and we may have still been more intense than other bands. But when he joined the band and he started playing, I mean, he wore us out for about 2 weeks. We had to basically learn how to match his intensity, which was great for us.
Well, there are very intense moments on your last record, The Secret Between the Shadow and the Soul. But there's also some very quiet and lyrical moments as well. So there's so many different directions, so many different elements that go into the creation of your music. It's not just jazz, but maybe taking things from maybe classical, since you also have that side of your music.
Yeah, of course. I mean, everybody in the band listens to classical music. And yeah, a lot of the rubato ballad, I mean, the idea is a classical idea. But you wouldn't confuse it with classical music. It's basically, that's the whole point, is we borrow from everywhere and from everything. We steal from all over the place. And we make it ours. But even the ballads have intensity. That's the whole thing, is that the intensity has to remain. I think that the word intensity is often misconstrued as being fast or aggressive. But intensity is like, we always try to play with a sense of urgency. Even on the ballad, like Joey wrote this ballad called Conversation Among the Ruins, and it's a sad song. So you have to play it with a certain kind of intensity to create that emotional effect. You can't just treat it like it's, it's the same thing as a fast song, except it's slow. The vocabulary has to change. Longer notes, longer sounds. It's just a completely, it's hard to really put into words. But the way one plays a ballad, because if you listen to a lot of modern jazz players, they do the thing Coltrane was doing toward the end of his life. They'll play the melody, and then there's a technique called double time feel, where if the tempo is 1, 2, 3, four for the solos, the tempo becomes one, two, three, four, one, which allows you to play faster. But what we like to do is keep it in the lower meter and use the space as a friend. Use the vacuum as opposed to avoiding the vacuum.
This is South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. My guest is saxophonist Branford Marsalis, who's performing with his quartet Wednesday evening at the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls. And early in your career, you were a member of Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers. I think this was around 1981, and so many other great musicians came up through the Jazz Messengers. And Art Blakey's centennial is coming up, so I thought I would mention that, because I'm wondering how important for you was playing in the Jazz Messengers in your development as a musician.
It was very important for me, because this is the first... that was my introduction to jazz in a lot of ways. I mean, I didn't really know a lot about jazz. I was more of an R&B sax player. And even though Wynton was more serious about playing jazz, we didn't really have a jazz vocabulary per se. You know, Wynton could play really fast. I couldn't. But we didn't really know enough about jazz and how jazz sounded. We didn't really understand the sound of jazz. And Blakey was really instrumental in giving me a template that I could use. It took me about 15 years after that to really put it all together. But he's the first person to really, he's not the first person to tell me that I sucked, but he was the first person to tell me why.
And that makes a big difference there.
It does.
Now you've mentioned, you know, learning the jazz vocabulary. You mentioned that with Justin Faulkner, and then yourself as a young musician. Is learning that jazz vocabulary something that you have to learn through older musicians and being on the bandstand and working night after night after night with great musicians who know more and have been out there longer?
There's a lot of musicians who have been playing 20 years and don't have a jazz vocabulary, you know, because they focus on harmony. I mean, it is such a hard thing to try to explain on the radio, but there's a certain kind of musical DNA involving melody and rhythm that jazz musicians prior to us had. Certain songs that were common to the development, and some of those songs weren't even songs that you would play on a gig, just songs that you should know. Songs like Taint What You Do But The Way How You Do It, or Saturday Night Fish Fry by Louis Jordan. All these songs that I'd hear the older guys sing to themselves and I didn't know. And I told Blakey, what are those songs? He goes, man, these songs are like the backbone of jazz. You got to know these songs to play the music the right way, because they were like pop tunes built from jazz vocabulary. And it took a while to learn that stuff, because it wasn't like now. I mean, if it was now, I would just, he would say the name of a song and I'd search for it in between a search engine or a music streaming program. You can find all of this stuff. You really had to go seek this stuff out 30 years ago, ordering records, and they were out of print, and you had to wait 6 weeks, and it was just all this, you know, you get lucky and something would come on the radio, and it was just like all, it was just a little more difficult to do than now. There's all these little things, and it's mostly music from the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, and a lot of current musicians tend to start with Charlie Parker, I start with Coltrane and go forward instead of going backwards. And the older guys helped me with the idea that in order to play futuristically, I had to have a firm foot in the past, and I had to do all of this research. So we were often playing songs on stage that no other group, my contemporaries, would never play those songs. Hell, some of the guys in the band didn't want to play those songs. But I really believed in what, you know, Benny Golson and Art Blakey and Roy Haynes and all those guys, I believed in what they were telling me.
Is there anything like Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers today for young musicians?
No. I mean, the musicians are far more ambitious now. You know, it's really hard to play non-popular music if you have a transactional relationship with everything, because you really wouldn't identify with the idea that they're things you should learn because they deserve to be learned, or you should love because they deserve to be loved. It's kind of like everything you learn, you want to understand prior to the research that there is a possibility of monetizing the thing that you've spent a significant amount of time learning or studying. And there's no way that you can say with any certainty that you will be able to monetize listening to Bessie Smith for 2 years or listening to Sidney Bechet for 5, because no one plays in that style anymore. No one sung like that for 100 years. I was recently doing a movie called Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I'm writing the music for it and working as a consultant. And the director really was adamant about finding someone who sounded like Ma Rainey. And I was trying to tell him, I can find you a person who has the voice that Ma Rainey has, but they won't be able to sing like her because nobody learns how to sing like that anymore. You'd do better finding somebody like an old R&B singer, a former R&B singer who has a foot in the church and the blues, so she would deliver emotionally. But if you found a carbon copy of a person who sings like Ma Rainey, but then their vocal inflections are all 21st century R&B, I mean, you can't, it's not going to work. And through the audition process, that's essentially what happened. Because it's impossible to get a young person who wants to be on TV, who wants to be a pop star, and say, well, if you really want to be good at this thing, listen to a singer that's been dead for 110 years. I mean, it's just, you know, you can't. People aren't willing to do it. And a lot of my colleagues weren't willing to do it. But when I had guys that I respected telling me that, I said, I have a feeling this is going to be worth the investment. And it took 15 or 20 years to percolate. But yeah, it's definitely worth the investment now.
Well, we're just about out of time here. So just to conclude, your visit to Sioux Falls is part of a tour that takes you to Kansas City and Tulsa and Illinois, Iowa, Missouri. Do you get the opportunity to perform in this part of the country much?
The Indiana-Illinois part, yeah. The South Dakota part, no. I think I performed in Sioux Falls once, and it was through the aid of the golfer Chris Cheddar, because she's from there and her family's from there. She kind of hooked up a gig for us because she's cool like that.
Well, it's great to have you here now. Are audiences different wherever you go? Or do you need to read in an audience? And what impact does that have then on your performance?
I mean, when you like jazz, then it doesn't matter, you know, because we have 100 years to play with. So, I mean, there was a concert not long ago where we were playing, and there was no real emotional feedback from our music, so we switched and started playing 40s tunes. And there was an immediate response. It's like, okay, we're just going to do this. So it just depends. I mean, I wasn't able to do that in my 20s because I only knew how to play one way. As a matter of fact, there's a great story. We were opening for Stan Getz in London. And we were playing in Royal Albert Hall, which before the redesign of it, or whatever it is that they call it, I never remember the word. The word escapes me right now. Where they reconfigure a room to make it more acoustically pristine. It was just this big, boomy marble room. And we were playing what we call burnout then, and the sound's bouncing all over the place. So before we played, I saw Stan, and I said, you know, Mr. Getz, I'm looking forward to hearing you. And he says, you're going to stick around? Good, because I've heard you play, and believe me, you could use some of what I'm doing. So I decided we're going to play the most difficult music that we can play. And we're playing, and after the third song, when I was getting ready to back announce the songs, someone from the audience yells, we can't understand a note you guys are playing. And, you know, a significant amount of the audience applauded and agreed with him because the sound was literally bouncing. But that was the only way we knew how to play. And after we finished, Stan comes up with his group. And he backs away from the microphone, and he plays pretty music all night, bosses, ballads, light things, because he's playing the room. And all we did was we just had this attack mode, and I watched the entire set. And when the concert was over, he walked past me. He says, did we learn something tonight? And I said, yes, sir, we sure did. He said, good, and walked away. And we never spoke again for the rest of his life. But it was a lesson that was really valuable. And I had some pushback from a couple of the guys in the band that were like, man, we should just go in there and play our song. I said, no, that doesn't work. We have to learn how to adapt to our surroundings. And as we started to do it, the guys were like, yeah, this is a good idea. It's nice to be able to play other ways in addition to our way. So, and that was in the 80s. So it's been on my mind for a long time. And now we can do it. We're good at it.
Is kind of what you're talking about, communication, being able to communicate with the audience?
No, we communicate to the audience whenever we play, because the entire band is charismatic, and most listening audiences hear with their eyes first, which is why the operative verb in the States for going to concerts is see, not hear. And the guys in the band are enjoyable to watch. What I'm talking about is a vocabulary-based reality, where we have this style of music that we played that was very aggressive and quite loud. And then suddenly we're playing in a room that doesn't like loud music, and we don't have a vocabulary to match that. We didn't have a vocabulary of softer songs and styles, and you have to have a certain kind of technique to play. Because we, like a lot of modern musicians, tend to play very soft to begin with, but we don't. So we had to learn how to play softer, learn how to play ballads, learn how to have more patience, learn how to play songs that are off the beaten path, not just going down the regular road and changing colors and changing styles.
That saxophonist Branford Marsalis, I spoke to him earlier this week for Jazz Nightly. And Branford Marsalis brings his quartet to Sioux Falls on Wednesday next week for an evening performance at the Washington Pavilion. Tickets are available through the Washington Pavilion box office. You can get them online, on the phone, or in person.